Well, I'm absolutely thrilled today to welcome Amy Ayoub to Culture Matters. Amy is a good friend. She is one of the most amazing women that I know, and I have a great deal of admiration for her. She is the feature in a new documentary called The Zen Speaker, Breaking the Silence, which is on sex trafficking. And she has this amazing, amazing story that I think all of us need to hear. And Amy, always just an amazing pleasure and thrill to talk with you. How are you today?
I'm fabulous and even more fabulous because I'm with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I love you so much. You're just amazing. And now, you teach public speaking, and yes, with it, which is, your business is called The Zen Speaker. So I assume that means speaking with some sort of peace in your soul, but I don't really know because I've never been, right? But now this new documentary, The Zen Speaker, Breaking the Silence. Tell us about that. And now, before we do that, I believe your father was a casino executive in Las Vegas. Is that correct?
Absolutely. He was, at the time, he was the youngest casino manager in the 1950s. When we moved here in 53, and when the Fremont Hotel opened, I think it was 56, he took over as casino manager there. He'd been a dealer before that.
And so how old were you when you moved into Las Vegas and that culture?
Moved here when I was 2.5. I was born in Washington, D.C., but I was only there for 6 weeks. And then we moved to join my father in Cuba.
So really?
At the time, a lot of the people that were in the gaming business were in the illegal gaming business, because Las Vegas was the only place that had become legal. And he had a whole group from his hometown of Steubenville, Ohio, that were all in the gaming business, his brothers and friends. And they moved to Cuba when it opened up there in the early 50s. It was, you know, as you've probably heard, just beautiful. Yeah. A lot of the casinos that are here are named after the casinos in Cuba, or vice versa. I'm not sure.
So just for our listeners, that was pre-Castro. Castro came into power, right? Like what, 1960, right in that area. So this was still Batista, and Cuba was considered the cultural hub of all of Latin America at that time. I was not familiar with that. The gaming business was drawing people from Steubenville, Ohio.
Right. But and from all over the world, it was the place to be. And everyone that was there at that time has said the same thing, that they've never been anywhere that was as beautiful and exciting as Cuba was at that time.
That's amazing. So that was like the Copacabana and all of that. And do you remember Cuba?
I do not remember it. I feel it. Right. I feel it a lot, but I don't remember it. My sister's 4 years older than me, and she remembers some of it.
Have you been back? Is there a desire in you to kind of be there, go back, discover it?
There's a huge desire for me to go back. I thought I was going to go back when it was opened up a little bit more a few years ago, and it just didn't turn out like I thought it was. So
there. Well, you could go with me, because we could go on a legitimate educational trip. See.
Okay, I'll book it. Give me the dates. We're gone.
We could study language and culture, and I'm sure we could get it approved by the U.S. government, right? In the documentary, the Zen Speaker, Breaking the Silence, and I know you have now come out very public in your advocacy for women who have been trafficked or in prostitution. Tell us your story. How did this come about? Your dad was a successful man. Just share with us what you would like to share with us.
So this is a 15-hour podcast, is that right?
Oh, gosh, I wish it was. We're going to have to get people to go and watch the documentary.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes, my dad was successful. He had his own demons. He was alcoholic, and my mother and he got divorced when I was 8, and I was very traumatized by it. I was daddy's girl. I wanted to go with him, and he certainly wasn't emotionally capable of that happened, you know, taking care of me alone, but I would run to him often and stay little bits of time. My mother remarried very quickly to an attorney, and I just had a horrible time with him. He had his demons, and it was very volatile. We had to move out of the home that we knew and loved right away, and just, he was violent. They'd have fights. My mom and dad had fights. My dad would come home drunk and violent sometimes, but I was protected by that. I never knew it. So there was a lot of chaos in the house. Also, my grandfather, my mother's father, had moved out here with us and lived with us when my mom and dad were married. And when my stepdad came, he made him move out. Mm. So that was our stability and our love. So that was really tough on us. And I started acting out. You know, I don't put blame on people because I have an older sister and a younger brother. And although they had their own issues, made their own choices, I went my way. So it's the same household, the same people, and yet we all turned out differently.
Right.
But I did start acting out and running away a lot and starting getting into situations where I was being groomed. I ran away once, got on a bus with another girl to LA. And luckily my stepdad and mom had the cops waiting at the bus stop. They found out before we got there where we were going, because I really think I would have been dead at that time, 14. Because some guys were on the bus, you know, and we were going to go with them.
Right.
So I got put away in schools that were where you're locked up in the school. One was Good Shepherd in Phoenix, and my mom and stepdad had control over that. They actually paid a little tuition, but the rest of the kids were from Phoenix and they were wards of the state. So that's where my manipulation started coming into play, and I would write lovely letters to my mom and say I'd be a good girl, right? So because she had control of getting me out, and she did, and I lasted a semester in school and then ran away, got in trouble again, ended up in juvenile hall, and then she had to she had to give up control, and I became a ward of the state and was put in a place called Kalyani Training School for Girls. It's now called Kalyani Youth Center.
Was that in Nevada?
It's about a couple hours outside of Las Vegas, out in the desert, and you're locked up.
Oh my.
But you go to school, and because school was not a problem for me, a lot of the kids did have problem because they were truant a lot. I went to Catholic school for quite a few years, and we were just a little bit ahead of the rest of the school district. So I was able to graduate, take extra classes, and I had enough credits to graduate early. So if I had been out, I wouldn't have graduated till the next year. But I was able to graduate at the end of the summer of what would have been right before my senior year. But I was able to graduate. And at that time, the school couldn't keep anyone who was either over 18 or had graduated from high school, because they didn't have anything to do. They didn't know what to do with you if you weren't going into the classes. So I had the choice my choices were if one of my parents take me, or they put me in foster care. And so my dad agreed to take me. And at the time he was working in Portugal, the casino there. So when Vegas started going corporate, my dad and my uncle and a lot of those guys left. And my dad was very well known for being an just expert teacher of the games. Mm. So he would be hired a lot around the world to come into the casinos that didn't have the American games yet and to teach them the American games, or if they were opening a new casino, to teach them the games. So he was in Portugal at the time. And my parole officer took me to the airport, put me on a plane, and I went to Portugal.
Oh my.
And I was 17. And it was not a healthy environment. So things happened that just made me have to come back within. It was a little less than a year. I was still 17 when I came back. And that's when I got groomed, when I started, you know, my behavior was promiscuous. It was looking for love in all the wrong places. And I was just looking for that type of attention. That's how I knew how to get attention. And so I was in situations where people were grooming me, where I started, you know, it's one of the reasons the documentary has helped me so much, because this is the part that's very difficult for me to talk about, because it's not clean. It's not just this happened and then that happened.
Right. So it's a process happened.
It was a bit long process, and that happens a lot. It's called grooming, and it can be all different ways that people just start setting you up into that direction. But
and who were those people, Amy?
One was a musician that I met that I thought was just a musician, and yet, you know, I went to LA with him, and all of a sudden he was introducing me to a girl who had a pimp who was literally dressing me, showering me, everything, getting me ready to put me out on the street.
Oh my.
And he did put me out on a corner, and Vegas at the time was like a small cowboy town still, even though it had casinos, it was a small town, and I freaked out. So I called that guy that took me there and said, if you don't come get me, I'm calling my parents or the cops or something. I'm not doing this. And and he did get me and brought me back here. And that remained kind of a long distance relationship, but it wasn't a committed relationship. So there were other people. He's the first person that he came in to visit, and I said something that was the wrong thing to say, and he started beating me with a wooden coat hanger, and that's the first time I might ever experience that. And we broke up, but it just set me up for low self-esteem, which I must have already had to even be there.
Sure.
But then a girl that I had met that I would become friends with invited me to make some money by dancing at a bachelor party with her, and that's all we have to do is dance. We got there, and it turned out that they wanted more than that. They wanted us to be together, and I had really long hair. I was trying to cover up, acting like I was actually touching her, and I wasn't, but covering up, and they could see that and got mad and said, "We paid for more than this," and I ended up being raped by about three of them.
Oh, my. I'm so sorry.
And it turned, and then she took me to her, what she called her boyfriend, and I saw her hand him money, so she knew all along. And this happens a lot, that the girls are traumatized and brutalized and just turned into the recruiters, And so he was loving, he said everything I needed to say in that traumatic time and treated me so nice and took me shopping and told me, just everything that I was wanting to hear, he knew to say. And I actually don't even know what happened to her. She kind of disappeared after a few weeks. But I ended up being with him for a few years. And he did, tell me what a great life we could have if I would just do this for money and he'd take care of me and we could do so many things and build this great life. And to me, it wasn't that far of a reach because it was just getting money for something I was already doing.
Right.
And
he was benefiting financially from that as well.
Absolutely. No, he took all the money. And it didn't get so, it didn't remain so loving, right? It became very abusive. Right. And when I did try and get away, and he caught me and beat me terribly and held me at knife point for a couple of days. And
oh my.
It's hard to run away, even though you physically might not be being held at gunpoint. It's hard to run away again when you tried and he came out of the blue and caught you. You think they'll always find you. And they convince you of that, right? There's brainwashing there. The work I've done since, in these past couple of years, since I spoke out, has been amazing to learn what trauma does to people. And, that was my trauma, but it's amazing how many people have different trauma from different circumstances in their life. And we're just walking around ready to explode or implode. And that's why I think I resonated so much with the work you're doing, because to me, your work boils down to, it's more complicated than this, but it really boils down to being respectful and being kind. And if we would do that, we would help so many people that we get mad at because we're not taking the time to understand where they're coming from.
So many good things come out of such deep pain, right? I mean, your story is, on one hand, incredibly sad, right? And at the same time now, it might sound a little bit cliche, but you're taking that pain and turning it into great purpose. But it took you many years to get to a point where you opened up about this, right? And in the meantime, you were able to develop a very successful career. When I first met you, I know you were working in some political consulting, and we've known each other now how many years? Several years now, right? And I know you have your teaching the public speaking with the Zen speaker. How were you able to, and I know that there's got to be this huge, long, deep story, So I almost feel guilty making this jump, right?
No, I understand.
How were you able to somehow get it together to some degree where you could develop a successful career and a successful life? What was that point for you? What allowed that to happen? How did you escape from that?
Yeah. A time came that I was in it like 6 years in that life. And a time came that I was in a situation where I could get away. And my father at that time was working in Monte Carlo. And I asked him if I could, even though I know it wasn't the healthiest place to be with him.
Right.
I asked him if I could come there because I felt I needed that distance, that I just part of my nature is, you know, the fight or flight was, I was always flighting, right? So yeah, I would run. And so even, so then it was, how can I get as far away as possible from this? That was my solution all the time. And it did help. It did help to get that distance where I was really away from people. They couldn't reach me. I could see a different world again. And, you know, I was raised with some gifts. I was raised, you know, I had good education. I was able to travel to meet people of all different nationalities and personalities. And so I had some experiences that a lot of the girls and boys also are in this. I work, you know, my experience has been with women, but the, you know, they don't always have that background that I had. So I went with him. I came back within a year, and my mother had a job waiting for me at a, her friend had a good job at a casino here. It was called the Holiday Casino. It's now Harrah's. And it was owned by a couple. And I felt I was ready to get out of that. And all the things that, you know, sometimes you hear things like, oh, you're not going to make as much money as you made. Well, I didn't keep any money. So if I get a dinky paycheck, at least it's mine, right?
Yes, yes.
So all those excuses, you know, there's another side to those. And I was able to, so at that time, they didn't ask for background checks. Right? I had an in through this executive assistant that was recommending me. So I didn't have to answer any questions. I just got the job.
Right.
And I moved very quickly into a executive assistant position. And I was just in heaven. I was using skills that I had. I got to deal with people in the casino industry. It's all about people and customer service. And my secretarial skills that I'd learned in a, you know, vocational school here of typing and things like that. I used that, and nobody knew. I got to be this new person and get attention for the good that I do and the good work that I did. And so I was still, however, just because I was out of that life didn't mean I was off drugs or alcohol or away from being promiscuous, right? So I was still living an unhealthy life for maybe 5 or 6 more years until I got clean and sober.
Did you end up going to rehab or something, or did you?
I went to the 12-step program.
Did you? And, okay.
During that time, I met somebody named Michelle Axalt, who was this daughter of our senator, our United States senator from Nevada, Paul Axalt. Totally opposite politically. We didn't agree on anything politically, but we just clicked personally. And she told me her secrets, and I told her mine. And she said, something I hadn't thought of was, she said, you have to get your record sealed. I had been arrested twice when I was 18 years old. Mm. And even though I was a teenager, it's still considered an adult. And that was going to stick with me the rest of my life. So because I got that record sealed, I could then always answer no to the question, have you ever been arrested? And that is what allowed me to build the life I have.
Wow.
Somebody recruited me for a job as a financial planner. I had no background in that. They were really recruiting me for business development in their financial planning business. Right. There's no way they would have done that if I had that record. There's no way I would have gone for the SEC license if I had that record. There's no way I'd get certain jobs. It's a charge to have a charge of soliciting for prostitution that just makes people a little uncomfortable hiring you, whether that's a woman that won't trust you with the men, with, you know, just all the stereotype thoughts that go along with that. I had met a state senator named Richard Bryan, who was running for AG, and I just fell in love with him, and that's how I got involved in politics. And I volunteered for many, many years, for a couple decades, really. And at one point in the late 90s, somebody that was our senator at the time and somebody running for county commission were asking me to help them a lot. You know, I volunteered a little, but they were asking a lot. And I said, you know, it's just cutting into my financial planning business, which I didn't like. It wasn't the place for me. But they said, no, we'll pay you. Like, and that's the first I heard somebody's going to pay me for doing what I love, what my volunteer work is doing. I'm all for that. And I left. I mean, I switched over my customer, you know, my clients to somebody else. And within a week, I was gone. Just as happy as I could be.
Actually, you and I met through, I think, Robert Elliott, who was chief of staff for Harry Reid, right?
And Harry Reid was one that had asked me to fundraise for him that year.
Oh, is that right? Okay, so that's the connection.
And then Rob came to my class also. Rob was in my class, but yes, so they, you know, that's a job that I wouldn't have been able to do at all if I had a record, because even if the candidate was okay with it, the campaign managers would say, why do we have to have somebody that people are going to make fun of or ask you why you have this person with this charge, you know, against them? And that's the time I was the most scared, I'm most afraid. That's the time, those 12 years I had that business, I just thought, who's going to tell, what's going to come out, when's it going to come out? Especially when I got candidates that were sheriffs or running for district attorney, that can they find out anyway, even though it's sealed? And even though it was sealed, there was always that fear.
Sure.
And I felt like a fraud because I wasn't being honest, right? Sometimes I'd get accolades or awards or just compliments. And every time somebody would say something nice, I'd think, if you only knew. And I truly felt if people knew that bit about me, that things would change, that I would lose my business, that I would lose friends, that it would just crumble my world. And then a time came that I couldn't keep it in any longer. You know, I got breast cancer. And to me, instead of thinking of the physical part of that, it hit me more of I had needed to get out of that business that had turned negative, and I needed to get the lie and the shame out of me. And even though they caught the cancer when it was, they caught it early, it was small, they thought it would be a lumpectomy, but they said, we won't really know till we go in there. I did some free writing, and I was writing out, it's going to be all black in there, it's going to be full of cancer because I'm this horrible person.
Oh my.
Yeah, it really overtook me. And that's when I knew I had to get it out, but I didn't know how. And the next year, I read an article about a young girl, 17, that had been in and out of detention homes and ran away and met somebody that started pimping her out, and he killed her. He strangled her, knocked out her teeth, cut off her tattoos so he could hide her identity. He was caught. And when I read it, I felt like I was reading about me. I felt like just one little difference, and that would have been me. And that's when I knew, you know, I thought, I can't read another story like this and not, I was just full of guilt. You know, not the savior syndrome, but to just feel like, could I have made a difference, right? Because I didn't know how. You know, it's like, am I supposed to grab a microphone and say, hey, everybody,
right.
Who cared?
Here's my past.
But our attorney general at the time was working on a bill called AB 67 that was going to increase the penalty. Well, first it was going to introduce the term sex trafficking as a crime. That wasn't even in the books yet here. And increase the penalty for traffickers, give some resources to victims. And I'd heard her talking, and she was somebody that had been a friend of mine. And I was feeling guilty that I wasn't helping her. And so I finally thought that that's what I've been waiting for. That's the time. So I told her the story, and she asked me if I would testify with her and share my story. Uh-huh. So at the time, it would have been 38 years since I'd been out of that life. And it's the first time I spoke publicly was in front of the legislature in Nevada.
Oh my.
A lot of the people on that committee had been fundraising clients of mine, had no idea.
And they knew you.
They knew me, and they didn't know that. And you know, that's
How was that received, Amy? Did you get mixed
reception? It was the opposite of what I thought, right?
Was it
just a tsunami of love? First of all, they were shocked. They were all crying, and it really threw them off, because you could tell afterwards that they had a whole different visual of what this looked like, what it meant, what, you know, it just was bigger than what they had thought, or different than what they had thought. And, you know, I'm very blessed that in the documentary, you'll see the chairman of that committee speaks and says that I made the difference in that bill. And the reason that that's important to me is to remind everybody that when you have an experience that's so personal to you, that to get the courage to share that does make a difference, and that it's our stories that connect us, right?
Yeah.
So they could have heard anything else from a legal side or, you know, factual side, but it's the stories that make the difference.
It must be incredibly liberating for you at this point in your life now. I mean, I'm just to be able to just be authentic and really just share deep from your soul. It's a risk, right, Amy?
Yeah.
I mean, And we're in a culture right now in the United States that, you know, past sins are can really cost people a lot right now. Even like, and this is a delicate conversation, and I'm sure, no doubt you would have thoughts on this, you know, like the Me Too movement, where you have men who have committed or acted in ways that really were very hurtful to women, right?
Yeah.
And at the same time, they're actually forced into not being open about it because they can't be. They can't, there's no place for healing for them if in fact they want to be healed, right? It's very complicated, right? And I would be interested in your thoughts, and I'm sure the people who listen to this would, just as it relates to your composite thoughts about the Me Too movement. And do you feel it's a healthy movement? Do you feel that there are elements of it that perhaps we should be handling a little bit differently? Do you think it's going the way it needs to go? What are your thoughts?
It's kind of hard because I think there's the movement is really individuals. And so they're all different. There's not just one thing that's happening, right? I think that we definitely have to, again, it just goes back to respect and listening, right? There, we can't keep saying people are lying. And when they finally come out with stories, you know, there was one reporter when I testified that was going around talking to other people who testified. And, you know, there was a mother whose daughter was out on the streets and she was speaking up. And he was challenging everybody that, oh, you sure that wasn't just a boyfriend, was it really a trafficker? Are you sure that you didn't do something in your home to have your daughter go out like that? I mean, it was really horrible. And that's just so, it re-traumatizes and it shuts you down.
Right.
We have to make sure that there are safe spaces to be able to talk. And that means safe spaces for both sides. Instead of the accusations and, you know, them against me kind of thing. We have to learn to have conversations. You've talked about that a lot, just politically, to not be able, you know, to lose friendships. There's so many people have ended friendships over the conversations of elected officials. It's ridiculous that you can't have, you know, like I said, my friend, Michelle Axelrod, did the biggest favor for me in my adult life. It was totally opposite.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So we know, you know, I know you have friends that are disagree with you. I mean, that's what
life is. I've learned to personally not take public positions on political issues because, you know, we're trying to reach a broader spectrum of people, right? And,
you know, but what I see kind of around your question is in a bigger scope, what I see in a, you know, every day with what I'm doing now is it's great to be able to speak up, but we can't just have people speaking up and not have a system that protects us and helps us in so many ways. So for me, I had the luxury, even though it was very painful to keep my shame in and to keep that secret, it was painful, but it also gave me the luxury of building a life that I was identified in different ways. You know, this didn't identify me. Or I had a better chance of not being identified by that. I was still afraid, you know, once people find out, will they forget everything else I did and just identify as that?
Right.
A lot of the people, you know, because we have this atmosphere of being able to speak up, you know, it's not all really true. It's not that safe to speak up, as you said. But there's this feeling that, okay, people are doing it, I can do it now. But if you don't have, if you're just not wrapped in love, at that time, it is very dangerous. So you speak up and what do you expect? Not everything's going to change except maybe how you feel, right? But that does, and especially when these are younger girls just getting out of the life and then being encouraged to speak up. You know, I don't encourage that. I encourage them to take my classes to get the confidence that speaking gives you.
Doesn't
necessarily to go around telling everything about you, you know, and telling your story all the time. So that's where we're lacking is, you know, if the Me Too movement needs to have not just other voices saying I believe them, but where is all the resources that can support you emotionally and physically? And
right. And where's the healing?
Yes.
Right. Absolutely. You said a couple of things. You know, one.
We all need it.
We all need it. The men need it as well, Amy.
The men need it the most. Well, I shouldn't say that. Well, but the men need it because the men that seem to be causing some of the pain are in pain.
Absolutely.
Right? People hurt people. So
that's right. We give away what we have.
Right. You know, there's talk about, you know, whenever I speak, somebody says, well, you know, what do you think about the traffickers? Don't they need help? And I said, they do. I'm not that advanced. You know, I wish I was. It's not going to come from me right now. Maybe someday. But of course they do.
You consider yourself more an advocate than an activist?
Yes. And I'm a very clear on where I feel I can help. So some people get involved and feel, you know, like everything they,
right.
they get, yeah. they can help somebody one-on-one. They can do this. You know, when I speak a lot, instead of saying, okay, you can help this organization or, you know, this is a way that you can help. Say there's one universal way everybody can help. It doesn't cost a dime. Stop victim blaming. Stop. Stop victim blaming and don't allow anybody in your presence to victim blame. Next time you want to make fun of the way that girl was dressed, just remember there could be blood all over that outfit when she gets home if she doesn't meet her quota. And that will make the biggest difference. A lot of the laws haven't changed. The perception hasn't changed because victim blaming is still, and bullying is still so prevalent. Or they don't know it and will say very hurtful things. They'll call names. They'll they don't do it long. I do speak up, but people feel like, it's just part of our conversation. You know, I'm going to pimp my car out. I'm going to, it's a good thing, right?
Right.
Or using the word whore. Very, you know, I'm a shoe whore. Right. No, you like shoes. Right? It's become cool, right, to use that.
Within certain cultures,
words
right?
matter. Yeah. Words really matter.
I have a question, and gosh, we could just talk forever here. You're fascinating and your story is fascinating. And I just want to tell you how much I admire you, just your courage. I mean, it's just amazing. As far as the trafficking is concerned of young girls, you know, and we see a great influx of migrants coming from Central America and Mexico. And of course you're in Nevada where there's a heavy population of that. And I think most people who've been to Vegas, you know, they see all these paper pamphlets passed out, you know, and a lot of these are Latino guys passing these things out. Are those girls that are being trafficked?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a conversation of, well, first of all, a lot of people think it's legal here, which it is not. It is legal in some counties in Nevada, which, by the way, there is now a movement to start.
Within brothels, however, it's not legal on the streets, is it?
Right. No, the brothels, there are no brothels allowed in Clark County, which encompasses Las Vegas, or Washoe County, which encompasses Reno. There's none. But sometimes the victim is the last person to know they're a victim.
Interesting.
So you start blaming yourself. It can be a combination of things. You start blaming yourself, you're brainwashed, you think that's all you're worth. Sometimes, you know, they'll talk about that it's a way to empower women, right? Women can be in this business and call the shots and make all this money. There, I can't imagine anything less empowering than having your body, you know, violated by strangers every day. But because of those conversations, a lot of times they don't look like victims. Or you'll see a girl getting arrested, you know, spitting at the cop and yelling at the cop and, no, I don't have a pimp and let me go. I want, you know, or saying that they want to do this, that they choose it. And they often feel like, I would have been that person. Once I was in for a while, I would have been that person. And when I testified, there was actually a small group that identify as sex workers that were against the bill, saying it could affect them. That movement has money behind it, which an organization, which means there's traffickers behind it.
Sure, absolutely.
But it also pits the girls against each other if we speak about it too much. I don't want to tell a girl that thinks that she's choosing it that you're wrong. You'll find out later, you know.
Right.
That doesn't serve any purpose. But I am here to tell people that not to be fooled. And, you know, when you ask about Me Too, I think sometimes there's those consequences that come from a Me Too movement that just lets people speak up, and they might not be speaking up about sexual abuse, but they get empowered to speak up about fair, you know, equal pay.
There's a little bit of a counter movement culturally now, and I've heard men actually say this to me in private that, you know, and of course this has been discussed, that some men are just saying, well, I'm not even going to hire women. I'm not going to hire a woman as an executive assistant anymore, this kind of thing. Or even men who are like, I'm not actually sure how to treat women in the workplace anymore. Do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's a cop-out. I feel like the people that think that way need to kind of look at themselves, that there might be something that they're doing. I would have a hard time believing that would be your reaction.
It wouldn't be my reaction.
Exactly. I mean, why? Why? Because you know that you're not doing anything.
You
also know that somebody could falsely accuse
it's
you.
Like
that
you kind of want to go, hold on a second. There are certain things you don't do. And right. They're common sense.
Right.
There are certain things you do that are common sense, that are respectful, and you can be loving without being lustful. I would tend to agree with you that I think it's a bit of a cop out on the part of most men who are saying this or doing this. It's almost like, well, I don't want to misstep sometime and have this kind of bite me back, you know?
Yeah, and I'm not going to hire a woman instead of learning how not to misstep.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. so we'll just, you know, the political polarization that we have, because you've been very heavily involved in politics. And this is something, obviously, you and I have talked about, I have deep concern over, and just the inability now of our political leaders to actually have civil conversations together for the overall common good of our country and of our communities. What would you say to those people?
Besides knock it off, right?
Yeah. It's like, you remember the Bob Newhart bit? This lady comes in and he says, you've got 5 minutes and it's $5. You ever see this?
Probably.
Yeah, Bob Newhart, comedian big. And she goes into this, I'm scared of dying alive in a box. And he listens to this and he just looks at her. He says, I'm going to tell you two words and just remember those two words. And she says, should I write this down? And he says, they're two words, you know? And he goes, he looks at her. He says, you ready? And she says, yes. He says, stop it.
That's exact. I think I scream that a couple times a day, actually. Just stop it, you guys.
Stop it. Like little third graders.
I mean, honestly, it's so sad. To me, it's very sad. We call them our leaders. They're not leading us at all.
Not.
It is on both sides that we're just seeing who can say the meanest thing in the most clever way, right? Let's figure out how to stop the communication. We wonder why we're not getting to solutions and to answers on, you know, the gun.
Can you imagine, Amy, in corporate America, if our vice presidents and our directors and our CEOs and CFOs, and they were talking to each other like that?
Cannot.
We'd be bankrupt.
I honestly don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen because it's so different than it has been. And we need not just one leader. It's never been. That's
not multiple
set up. They're all need to come together for the solutions of the problems. And if they would concentrate on that, if they would, like you do in a company, right, or on a committee, get together, how do we get this solution? Instead of who is the most popular and who has the most followers and who gets the most brings out the most controversy on social media.
I've brought this to you. I'm going to bring it back to you now. And I'm going to do this publicly now. See, I want to get together for cultural mastery cohorts. You know, there are six people. I want three Democrat leaders and three Republican leaders. So if you'll help me make that happen, I will be thrilled.
Absolutely.
We have to start. I think we almost have to retrain people on how to learn to respect and love one another, even if they disagree.
We're not going to get any real effective leadership if people can't talk to each other and respect each other.
It's impossible. My guest today is Amy Ayoub, who is one of the most fascinating people I know. And I just think the world of you. Thank you so much, Amy, for coming on Culture Matters. You are a delight and you are a blessing. And I'm sure that you have brought an incredible amount of thought process to a lot of people today. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for everything you're doing.